The Crawdaddy Rock Review now delivers a brief listen to a bit of unsettling news and nonsense facts gathered from the National Neighborhood. If it's really all the same, the Army has decided to give women the boot. The same boot camp, that is. Up to now, certain phases of WAC basic training were adjusted for differences in strength and stamina, but a comparative study of more than 1,600 men and women recruits showed little difference in relative performances. The only exception was in areas requiring upper body strength, such as obstacle courses and speed marches. Even so, the Army reports in 60% of the tests given, women met or exceeded minimum standards. As a result, beginning next fall, Army WACs will get the same boot. The old cops and robbers chase may soon become blimps and burglars. A local police department in California is weighing the advantages of using pilotless blimps on airborne patrol. The small cruising gas bags would be armed with searchlights, a PA system, and a zoom lens camera. The police expect to save an average of $120 an hour over the cost of using the more conventional pilot with helicopter team. There's a time savings, too. After all, blimps don't need lunch breaks or comfort stops. During a routine check of their reference collection, scientists at New York City's Botanical Gardens turned over an old leaf and rediscovered specimens that are 30 million years old and still green. Similar to leaves pressed in the pages of a book, they were originally trapped by volcanic ashfall in Oregon, which preserved them in a dry, sterile environment. The ancient specimens are from elm and hackberry trees that flourished in the epoch before the Rocky Mountains were lifted up. When the trees were alive, North America was the home of three-toed horses, humpless camels, pigs 7 feet high, and rhinos 12 feet long. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader may earn the title of good sport yet. Nader's next target will probably be what he calls the massive rip-offs in the world of sports. He would like to see a national fans organization that would challenge everything from bloated ticket prices to the quality of junk food sold at ballparks to the trading of popular players without regard to fan loyalty. Nader thinks setting up the group will be easy, as he describes public interest people as all latent sports fans. That's it for today's Nonsense News. This is Pete Fornital with the Crawdaddy Rock Review, brought to you by Discwasher.
You're the poetry man. You make things all right. Yeah.
This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, brought to you by Discwasher. My guest today, Phoebe Snow. Were you prepared for success when it came?
Oh, God, no. Can't you tell? Did I acclimate beautifully, or did I fade into oblivion? Of course not. No amount of preparation is ever gonna get you ready for what it is, the onslaught of success.
Is it even what you wanted, or what you imagined it to be?
I don't know. I guess every kid has their daydreams and their fantasies of whatever.
Were yours?
I had my fantasies that, you know, I really always liked theatrical stuff. I always loved music, and I always loved the theater, you know, legit theater.
And the writing that you did was more poetry than song lyrics at first, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, poetry was always my favorite thing to read and to write. I mean, Shakespeare. Oh, the more, you know, voluminous and the more verbose and everything that the poetry was, the more I loved it. Didn't understand a word of it, you know. But those great were like John Donne, you know, go on for days. I don't know what he was talking about. It just sounded so great, you know. And I tried to do that, and I think I got a little bit obtuse after a while. You know, I started to write these lyrics that nobody like Second Childhood, for instance. Every different critic had a different interpretation of what I know what that means. You see, she's talking about it's this and that, and I said, but I didn't even know what I meant. I was doing a John Donne on myself, you know. I just wrote whatever I felt as a stream of consciousness, you know.
Does it bother you that people derive interpretations of your work far from what you had in mind?
No, I think it's funny. Like what they did with the Beatles and stuff like
sure.
that.
Sure.
You know? What does the walrus really mean? Yeah. And is Paul really dead? And all this stuff, you know. I mean, so what?
When, let's backtrack again to... When the poetry became lyrics, became intended for the song form as opposed to the printed page or the written word.
When someone told me I could make money doing it.
Ha ha! Art rears its ugly little head again,
yes,
eh?
Well, they said, you know, just it's no sweat. You just go home and hum, make the words fit the hum, and put the thing. I said okay, because I couldn't read or write music.
All right, to go along with the income, did you construct a fantasy of fame as well as fortune?
Once I started to get, you know, real serious about that, I was going to do this thing. And not only was I going to write them and sing them, but in front of people, terror came in, you know. And I said, "Well, I have too much stage fright to ever do this as a career thing, you know, because I would get up in front of audiences and I would be just terrified." Now I'm not anymore. I don't care anymore. But in the earlier days, in the club days, when it was a really intimate thing. You really saw your whole audience and you really related to them and saw their facial expressions and stuff. It was too much of a personal thing. I mean, it was too intimate. It was too close for comfort, you know. And that's a good way to break yourself in and get your stuff together, you know. But I thought, well, this is like group therapy. I have to pour my guts out to them every night. No, I can't do this for a living. Are you kidding? And it hit me right in the midst of, you know, the success thing with the album taking off.
Yeah, to many, you came literally from nowhere.
I did. But that's not totally true. I mean, I know I'm always having these guilt trips about, well, I didn't pay enough dues or something. Hey, listen, I'm paying dues. Is everybody happy now? No, it's okay, really. But in the earlier days, it was so abrupt, you know. It was so out of left field. I mean,
yeah.
I was doing amateur nights. I never even got a paying gig.
Okay, let's stop here, and when we come back, we'll listen to a sample of your music from that time. This is Pete Fornatale with Phoebe Snow, and we'll now listen to a cut from the first Phoebe Snow album, Poetry Man.
You're the poetry man. You make things all right. Yeah.
From the first Phoebe Snow album, Poetry Man. And that album contributed to a definite mystery physically from the from the impression on the cover. Did you run into problems because
of
that?
Yeah, well, I don't know about problems. There was one crazy thing that happened, though, before the album even came out. I know a lot of people thought that I was black. And who knows? I still could be. Keep the ambiguity up.
That's
well,
right, Reed.
No, I don't care, you know. It's really interesting because I also supposedly sounded like very R&B influenced, you know. So, which I am. Sure I am. You know, everybody is. If there was no R&B, there wouldn't be no rock and roll. You
no
know
way.
I mean? No Little Richard, no nobody. What happened is I was opening for Edwin Hawkins. It was a predominantly black audience. I mean, because Edwin Hawkins was a gospel group. And I sang my little set, and I ended it with San Francisco Bay Blues, which was, I thought, just about the most stylistic soul interpretive thing I ever did, right? And I got, you know, off the stage, and I feel this hand on my arm, right? And I'm not going anywhere, and someone's got a good grip on me, and the next thing I know, there's a flashlight on, shining in my eyes. And it's these three black women are sitting there, and one of them's got a flashlight. They're pretty tough, too. I mean, they want, you know, and they're shining, and they says, "Well, is she or ain't she?" And they said, "Are you or are you not?" And I said, "Well, I am." And one of them goes, "I told you, I told you." I said, "But I'm not." She goes, "Oh,
you
it was
crushed.
Hysterical." But they said, "You know, it doesn't really even matter."
Greatest compliment they could have given
you. That was one of my first things that was ever said to me, is it doesn't matter what you are, you know?
Let's backtrack again to your incredible sudden rise to fame. When did you really feel like it was happening?
I think when I really began to feel the initial thrust of it was on the Jackson Browne tour. I was just sort of plunked into a recording studio, plunked onto a tour. It was all a very ready-made thing, you know? It turned out to be great. I mean, that Jackson Browne tour was great for me. And great for him, I think, too. I think he dug it.
Was the single happening at that time?
It began to happen while I was out there.
Oh, wow.
It was the second one released from the album. First of all, a single. I thought that album was the least commercial thing I'd ever heard in my life. From what my basic, you know, sort of peripheral knowledge of AM radio is, I said, "God, that there's no single on there." I heard them talking singles in the studio. I said, "What? Dude, are you crazy?" So when that happened, I think, by that time, I had road burn up to my ears. I mean, I was so burned out from the road, and I was pregnant, too, and didn't know it.
Mm.
I was exhausted all the time, and I managed to schlep my body onto the stage every night and do a show, and sometimes they were very good shows, I guess. And I didn't know what was going on half the time. I was just in a blue fog. I mean, I sort of, things just were hurled at me, you know? It's kind of like being stoned and things get hurled at you and you just go, yes, you know, I mean, no, maybe. So much stuff was happening so fast. It all happened too fast.
Yeah, it
problem.
Seems that it blunted your ability to enjoy what was happening
it
to you.
It did, indeed. It did. I hated a lot of it. I was very resentful. I harbored too many resentments for too long a time. I was angry at other people. This is important, by the way. I was angry at everybody but the right person, which was me, because I allowed, by my lax kind of attitude, and I let a lot of things, I allowed a lot of things to affect me and happen to me, and I signed a lot of papers, and I made a lot of bad judgments, because I don't know why, and what the reason I'm saying this is because the real person that I should have been angry at is me, and I still am angry at myself today, because it was through my own fault, my mistakes, that things didn't happen the way they should have. I mean, I know it was me now, and I'm atoning for all that now in a big way, because
How so?
Well, I think that my career has gone, I don't know whether you call it a holding pattern or a downtrend, but it's kind of quiet now, whereas all the publicity and all the flurry of craziness was happening before with the first album, and the first album also was a real sleeper commercial success, and sold the best of any of the three. I think also because of that success, which came from literally nowhere, I had a tendency to be very lazy and say, well, I don't have to do anything the next time, because I sure didn't do anything this time. All I did was go in and go la la la, and it's a big success, right? So I didn't do nothing for the next two times. I think the third album I kind of put a lot of sweat into.
Was there a turning point? Did one thing turn things around to a better place for you?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of things. First of all, I believe I dissipated a lot. I didn't want to participate even anymore in any kind of a way. And I spent January of this year in bed, you know?
That's frightening.
But I guess that's what I needed. That was the kind of kick that I needed, you know? Because as soon as I hit that kind of real dangerous rock bottom, I said, wait a minute. I better participate in life if I'm going to have a life, you know? Everything I heard about me in the end, when I was really grasping at straws and really reaching my rock bottom, I would read a review to find out who I was. I had to be alone. I had to just take a hiatus from everybody and say, okay, here's the mirror, here's your body, here's your face. Who are you? What are you? I mean, what are you doing here? What do you hope to do here later? What did you do, and how can you learn from the mistakes you made rather than curse them and have a vengeful attitude about them? I mean, I really want to enjoy life, you know?
Did you answer all of those questions for yourself?
I feel like I'm getting towards some pretty good answers now. It's hard work, I gotta tell you. It really hurts.
Sure.
Okay, when Elvis Presley died, right, and the press had a field day with him, they did it when he was alive. He was at his rock bottom. I identified so much in those last 5 months of his life. I think most entertainers who were hurting did, you know? He was, first of all, the fat thing. I mean, I really identified with that. And second of all, I have no idea what kind of an existence he must have lived, except had I had the continued fame that the first album brought me, and continued to open the LA Times to find out who I was, and continued to call 5 people every day to run all my errands for me, and literally breathe for me. See, the thing is, in the last 5 months of Elvis's life, a lot of light, some of his confidants and some of the people that he depended on turned around and blew the whistle on him, like this guy was a big child, you know? And I thought, when that happened, when that whole sensational tabloid kind of press coverage started to happen before his death, I felt like, I want to go and find this guy. I've got to talk to him, because it was in my period of climbing up again, and I've got to get well, you know, I've got to get myself together again. I began to just feel like I wanted to reach out to Elvis Presley. I didn't know him. I had no idea the mammoth proportions of his superstardom. How did he get there? I mean, how did he do? He was just a nice guy, you know? He's just a guy who could sing real pretty, you know? Why did that have to happen? He was a very young man when he died. He literally died of just excess. He died of excess and not being able to live his own life. I saw myself predisposed to that kind of existence. I think maybe Elvis, for all of his power and magnetic ability with an audience, once he walked off that stage, he probably had no idea who
he was.
Sure,
he was strangled by his media persona. I know exactly what you're saying.
That's it. And that's the tragedy of it all. That's Jimi Hendrix, that's Janis Joplin.
Boy, you think we would learn from the recurrence of it, but
we never do.
Not too many do.
I didn't in any way, shape, or form mean to equate myself professionally with Elvis Presley. No one will ever, I think, probably equal the stature that he reached.
What's ahead for
Phoebe
Snow?
Well, now I really feel that to have a career, it needs me. It needs me a lot. It needs much more energy. I can't get by on a pass.
Tell us about the new album.
Oh, well, I really like the new album a lot. I like it. It's Phil Ramone produced it. And it's less original songs than I've ever had on an album before. Because I just write whatever pops out. There are 5 original songs and 4 non-originals, and I'll tell you about the 4 non-originals.
Yeah, you choose some
weird
things to do.
I know.
What 4 have you unearthed for us?
An old song that I heard with the Jim Queskin Jug Band called Garden of Joy Blues. They did it with kazoos and washtub bass and everything, and I just made it into a real slow blues, real slow acoustic blues. And it's got great lyrics. I mean, the lyrics are really funny. Then there's a song by Stephen Bishop, who is getting so hot now.
Talented.
Thank goodness.
Boy.
So, Never Letting Go is the name of the song. And it's just...
Has he recorded it? Is that on the album?
Yeah, it's on his. It's about an affair that's not going too hot. But I'm the one, the unrequited lover, you know, who goes, well, I really love you and you're not paying any attention to me, but I'm never letting go. It's great. So that's the title of the album, too.
Let's take some time out right here and listen.
I thought I'd drop by, so nice to see you. It's been too long since I was holding you. I've been holding on to a prayer, 'cause my dreams never seem to come true. I'm never letting go, never letting go, never letting go. It's not that easy. I'm never letting go, never letting go, never letting go. I'm crazy about you, but I can't live without you. I left the kitchen light on these past 3 nights. It don't blow out, just keep shining bright. And now your eyes, they dance away from mine. Is it someone else again this time? I'm never letting go, never letting go, never letting go. It's not that easy. I'm never letting go, never letting go, never letting go. I'm crazy about you, yeah. I could be a lady and walk away with style, but I'll fight to keep you, throw my arms around you. This is crazy, I know, but I just got to show.
That's Never Letting Go, the title song from the new Phoebe Snow album and the new single as well. Let's continue. What are the other non-original cuts on the album?
Oh, yeah, real hand-clapper, finger-popping bid for commercial success. No, I'm joking. It's Love Makes the Woman. Do you remember the old Brunswick record by Barbara Acklin?
And the fourth?
It's Paul Simon's song, Something So Right.
Oh.
As she pays homage to a man who aided her career. No, I mean, really, Something So Right, the words to that, right? Doesn't everybody identify
that? That is,
with
I think, Paul Simon's only true love song. Mm-hmm. I look forward to hearing your version of his song. I also have to tell you that this is probably one of the more terrifically candid sessions that we have had here, for which I thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Continued success in an amazing career, and please come back and see us again.
Yeah, for chapter 2.
You got a deal. You've been listening to the Crawdaddy Rock Review with me, Pete Fornatale. The Crawdaddy Rock Review is produced by Cinema Sound Limited in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Disc Washer. Production techniques and engineering by Martin Brooks. Direction by Leonard Dugo.